Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
This is part two of the session I had with Geert van der Wouw of Shell Ventures, where he outlines Shell's history in innovation and venturing, mobility and energy, and what's happening now during the pandemic.
A couple of things, Shell Ventures is we're an old bunch. We started with venturing back in 1997, which makes us probably one of the older venture units in the energy industry, or in the industry as a whole, maybe. So we've gone through various trials and tribulations and metamorphosis. We've got many scars on our back as a venture unit, learned the wrong way and the right way how to go about corporate venturing. And we're always happy to help others in the industry that are just, starting to get their feet on the ground to do it right the first time instead of the fifth time like we did. Initially we're focused on oil and gas, as you can imagine, in the early days. And we did a lot of spin outs from the Shell wells and deep water technology community. And then later started to invest more and more in external startups more directly. And over time, we've seen our portfolio shift from pure oil and gas to more and more renewable power and heat and mobility investments. And today our portfolio is probably about 60% of the latter. Well, probably more, 70% of the latter, and only 30% oil and gas, with oil and gas slowly and gradually probably diminishing over time, but still important as we continue to focus on deep water, for example, and try and make our business more competitive going forward. We've got several innovation vehicles in Shell, and I think Andrew, you were associated with Game Changer in the early days, back in the 90s. But we got a group in the research community that focuses on connections with universities. We call them Research Connect. We got about, I think, 800 collaboration agreements with universities across the globe. And also a long-range research group, LLR, that looks at breakthrough technologies and science in the renewable energy space. Game Changer typically gets involved a bit earlier than we do in the TRL2 to TRL4 space. And they really are a small group of folk that focus on helping early stage, very early stage, seed stage type entrepreneurs bring their product to market and do a proof of concept. And at the latter point, we may or may not, as Shell Ventures, do a small investment. But typically, we start a bit later than where Game Changer stops. And Shell TechWorks is an organization in Boston that Peter from DSM knows, and they are kind of a rapid prototyping organization, Shell's version of Skunkworks, and they'll take technologies from other industries and try to rapidly prototype them for an application in the energy industry. And then Shell Ventures is the corporate venturing organization of Shell, which I'm heading. My background is I'm a biochemical biotech engineer by origin, I worked in Fluor for about 15 years in the engineering construction industry, joined Shell about 15 years ago, mostly worked in new business development, M&A, and 8 years ago was asked to lead Shell Ventures and kind of restarted as we had spun the previous version out from Shell. That's a bit on myself. This is where we're based today, in seven different locations across the globe, with small teams of about 4 to 6 people from San Francisco, Boston, Houston, to London, Netherlands, Beijing, and Bangalore, from where my folks source investment opportunities for the broader Shell in three verticals. We lead and follow deals. We always work in syndicates with other corporate investors or VCs, and at times with family offices and impact investors. we try to balance between things that the business sees near immediate opportunities to deploy and more long-term strategic, potentially more disruptive plays that the business doesn't yet see as a threat or as an opportunity, but we know they will be asking us 3-4 years from now. We always take minority investments. We never want to be more than, say, 30-35% of the cap table, and investments range between 2 and 25 million per ticket. It's a pretty wide range. We look at three verticals, from resources, which is primarily focused on those propositions that require quite an investment in equipment and in hardware and in, say, process engineering, ranging from oil and gas to things like hydrogen and the bioeconomy, plastic recycling, nature-based solutions, stuff like that. Clearly, that market is currently quite depressed. We see actually good opportunities becoming available. The main challenge we're facing there's very few acquirers at this point, particularly in oil and gas, to buy these startups in the end of the day. But we do see quite a good uptick in our business for the technologies that we have bought into as a minority investor. The second vertical for us is power and heat. That's more the whole renewable space. We focus on things around trading platforms, meter data analytics, energy IoT, local and distributed energy models, thermal technology and solutions, climate impact, carbon reduction, those kind of things. We do see one of the biggest challenges there is the long sales cycles with the utilities that service their customers. And so the failure rate is pretty high. So we tend to go fairly late stage when we invest in power propositions. And on the mobility side, that remains a pretty strong market, although China has clearly diminished quite a bit over the last couple of months. And our focus there is around fleet of the future, mobility as a service, new kind of service models in general, and also sustainability. We see still a lot of money being plowed into that sector, which challenges some of the valuations that we see in the market, which makes us a bit wary, a bit careful in not overpaying, as at some point, the chicken will come home to roost. But it remains a very active market for us. And today, I think, you know, probably 80% of the opportunities that we look at fall within the power and heat or mobility domain. This is a snapshot of our portfolio. Today we have about 80 companies in our portfolio, and we sit on the boards of most of these companies, either as an observer or as a director or both, depending on our percentage share and our long-term involvement in those companies. We also are an investor in funds. We have a fund of fund capability where we invest in as a limited partner in VC funds that can give us access to particular markets where initially we may not have had a lot of exposure. Like we invested in a fund in Israel called Manif. We invested in a fund in China, GRC. But also we are a limited partner in Energy Ventures, which is one of the leading growth equity type providers in the oil and gas and increasingly also now in more renewable spaces. So it's a really nice model for us to actually use their funnel as a way to feed ours, and that's working quite well. This is a little bit the global distribution. I would say China and India are probably the largest growth markets for us at the moment. If I discount the energy access portfolio that we're building in Africa in support of our energy access business. Now we do spend a lot of time in helping our ventures to land contracts with Shell, and we do then track and trace how much value we create in the businesses, in terms of the free cash flow we add to the bottom line of those businesses. And that's working really well. It was a lot of hard work in the beginning, and it's taken us 3 years to get to a model that works for us. And here are a couple of examples of companies that are clearly doing well in our assets. Halfwave is a company we recently exited, but they've landed a large contract with our assets in Brazil and with Petrobras in Brazil, with whom we have a joint venture, to do real-time integrity inspections on risers and flow lines in the deep water. Axelos is one of the leading digital twin technologies for civil structural analysis. They have recently completed the largest digital twin of any asset in the world. That's our Bonga FPSO of Nigeria. And they basically allow us to really look at extending the life expectancy of large assets, saving our businesses a lot of money. Corvus is a company we are co-invested in with Equinor. And they basically are leaders in the electrification of the whole marine sector. And we are looking with Corvus at electrifying several of our supply vessels and maintenance vessels in the offshore, but also increasingly offering them to our customers in the marine space. So Cumulus is an interesting company. We spun out from Shell. They kind of developed basically a digital maintenance platform. And one of their first products is a electric torque system that basically allows you to very precisely torque bolts on flanges and reduce the amount of leakage in petrochemical and refining sites. And they're doing quite well. They are currently working on more than 20 sites, including mostly external non-Shell customers. So we do have a team in my organization, about five people that, which includes contracting and procurement. And they spend most of their days connecting the startups with our projects and our asset community to make sure that they land contracts within Shell. And even during COVID, that actually is still going quite strongly. So we're quite happy with that. That's a bit of the introduction to Shell Ventures. I wanted to keep it short on purpose, Andrew. So maybe we can just go back to having a dialogue and conversation.
Yeah, no, excellent. That's great. What's your view at the moment on, you said valuations are too high. You know what, we're seeing what's happening with the tech businesses on NASDAQ and on the markets and the multiples that are that now there for the likes of Tesla. What's your view on the valuations at the, at the venture sort of side of things? How are you seeing things pan out?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, I see differences in terms of regions, but also in terms of sectors. So it's kind of hard to give a short answer to it, Andrew. But for example, in mobility, we see clearly that the Chinese market has cooled down quite a bit. And we continue to source for deals there in the mobility space. But on the other side, in Europe, it's going fairly strong on average. So it depends really per region what valuations are doing. Obviously, oil and gas is extremely depressed, and there's actually some, I think, good investment opportunities emerging there. But clearly, the life cycle of and the holding periods on portfolio companies, is going up. And then in power, again, it's quite regional. It's hard to. It's certainly not. It's got a dip from COVID, but it's quite a resilient sector, as we do see that as a result of COVID, actually many companies, if anything, especially large energy companies, except for some of them in the United States, Kemal, although you guys have set up a fund, Kemal, so that's good. But, the European, say, IOCs have all kind of strengthened and emboldened their climate targets in recent months, so you do see that that actually gives a floor to the renewable power market.
Good, thank you. So we've got some comments that have come through and some questions, I guess. So Ernie, you sort of picked up on the point about VCs struggle between the gap of the initial sort of innovation and the full-scale adoption, which I think builds on Kurt's point about taking these things that they invest in and putting them into the core business. Would you like to elaborate on your point there to get the view from the corporates who were on the call on how they scale things or connect them to the business?
That's a question to me or to?
Well, I was going to ask Ernie, if he wants to unmute, he can sort of ask the question. But that's basically the question that was here, that there seems to be a gap between when VCs invest and then corporates come on board or do the transition. And to me, that's always the big power that the corporates can do, is how do you help these things scale and go global?
Yeah. The best way for us to develop a brand of being a good co-investor to, say, financial VCs and other corporates is by showing that ability to help scale these companies, right? I mean, that's where we show real value as a strategic investor. And there's no silver bullets. It's actually a lot of hard work in the end of the day, because the energy sector is quite a conservative sector when it comes to buying behaviors. And you know, sales cycles are long, qualification processes are complicated. And that obviously is a complicating factor. So putting a deliberate effort on it is really important for us.
Mm.
Yeah. Good. I mean, besides not invented here syndromes, you know, we see often also kind of a race to be second in our company, where, you know, asset managers are fascinated by technology, but they don't want to be first. They wait for somebody else to start the first pilot.
Yeah.
And I think generally the prevailing culture in our industry is still one where we run away from any possible mistake and focus on avoiding new ones, right? So it's and that's clear, because the impact of a failure in, say, a petrochemical plant can be catastrophic. So that's where that culture comes from originally. Yeah. But fear of making mistakes is obviously a pretty bad environment for innovation. So, you know, we really are changing that now that we are moving into the energy transition, and it's a cultural change more than anything else.
Good. And you touched on, and we've got experience of China, but India, what's your view on the VC market and that within India?
It's certainly blossoming. There's not a lot of experience yet with some of those VCs, and so we're having to help them on the learning curve, to be frank. And obviously, you know, governance can be a challenge in terms of how boards operate and you know, how you can represent yourself on those boards and make sure that management teams behave. But it's clearly developing rapidly and it's catching up, especially in the mobility sector. We see a lot of very interesting opportunities for us. And India happens to be quite a growth market for Shell as a whole, whether it's in retail or in petrochem or in LNG or those sides of our business. And certainly now with renewable energy, you know, expansion into solar is on our list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another question, your perspective is really around this whole sort of future of mobility and energy, and this the whole sort of grid power, renewables, the mix of hydrogen, different energy vectors and stuff like that. How are you getting that balance? Because you outlined your sort of three columns and the areas and you're in. The interaction and the value chain is getting quite complex around those parts now. And how are you getting your head around those various parts of this new grid and energy infrastructure?
Yes, I mean, on the power side, it's the opportunities are quite interesting from a venturing perspective, also because a lot of the opportunities are quite digitally enabled and the amount of hardware involved is fairly limited. Where I start to get some shivers is when people start talking about hydrogen, right? I mean, hydrogen is back, and yes, we have, you know, quite strong ambitions in the hydrogen space as a company. But of course, we've all learned what happened to cleantech 1.0, and most people lost their shirt, if not everyone lost their shirt, primarily because in the end of the day, the scaling of that industry proved out to be really hard. And, you know, there wasn't enough capital and offtake around to make it happen. Now, I think I'm hopeful that this time it's for real, as large energy companies are moving into domains like hydrogen. But it requires a lot more capital, and to a point where you got to question whether it's actually a venturable space or whether we need to find other structures for funding growth and scaling in hydrogen.
Yeah, but I think that's a similar issue also in the EV space, in that in that value chain that I put up that Samantha and I did earlier, one of the challenges from lots of the corporates that were in that session we did at Williams was, what's the new financing model across that value chain? Because putting, like in the UK example, putting 20 million sockets at people's homes and at stations and work locations and stuff like that is not a VC play in that either. And I think that's a big challenge in all of these areas, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and building the first pilot plant typically takes, what, $50 to $150 million. And the VCs by that time have lost patience and have tapped out, and they want to raise a new fund and they want to get out and been there, done it. So, yeah, we're looking at different models to finance that kind of growth.
Yeah, yeah, good. And a couple of quick questions around the pandemic slowing down economic progress on many portfolio companies and funds extending their portfolio runway or diversifying new investments in different areas. So, Gert, what's your view on? And also, I'd like to come back and ask maybe Kamel and some others in a moment on their view on how they're managing the portfolio. So, what's your help in the runway, etc.?
Yeah, I mean. I mean, the first thing we did is we sent a letter and connected with all of the portfolio companies to help them preserve cash. Yeah. And especially also to preserve cash to invest in growth again later during the year. Depending on the management teams and the quality of the syndicate, you know, they were on top of it and they did preserve cash. And others, it took some time for reality to sink in. Particularly those where you have family offices and impact investors on the in the syndicate, you know, it's they have a slightly more romantic view on venturing than others. But in general, I think we got a bit lucky by the fact that a lot of our startups raised capital in 2019. So generally, they're quite well funded. The ones that need funding, with the exception of one and two, will probably be able to raise funding. So I think, to be frank, we got a bit lucky there. The immediate action was basically to try and help them extend the runway, but also help them land contracts in Shell. And that has been quite successful because, for example, on the oil and gas side, we've invested mostly in things that can save money in the assets. And so, of course, in a cash-constrained world, people in our assets only want to invest in things that save money. And so we did land quite a few contracts this year, which was quite encouraging.
You raised a point there about doing new deals. The last discussion session we did was with Henkel, with Paolo, and the videos on our channel where we were discussing that, because I think as we move through this transition now, when you're running out of the deals and the relationships you've got, how you build the new relationships or how you build the connections, it's going to be an interesting transition that we need to make as an industry.
And we lost one company so far, and that was Glasspoint, which is a concentrated solar play. The technology was still, we believe, the leading technology in concentrated solar for heat. We built a world-scale plant in Oman last year, the year before, you know, producing a lot of steam for in-situ heavy oil upgrading. And it was very successful. And we were about to close on a large industrial to put another $30 million in. And at the very last minute, just days after COVID started to hit us, they pulled out, being fearful of the nearby future. And so that was an example where, unfortunately, is an unfortunate victim of COVID in a way, because fundamentally we still believe in the technology, but we didn't want to be the only investor with deep pockets around the table. So we had to let that company go.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is quite an incestuous business, and it's the way that venturing in the energy space works, because these sales cycles are so long, Jan. You actually need more than one strategic typically on your cap table. And so we got a case in hand now where we actually, and we do this often, we actually, you know, working with the management team to find more strategics to co-invest with us. And they are, in the traditional sense, are competitors to us. But in terms of helping us to grow these companies, they are essential. And we've never blocked a credible strategic from a syndicate.
Yeah, I'd reinforce that as well. I see the oil sector quite similar to the health sector. The amount of investment, the amount of time and the pharmaceutical health sector, the corporate venture units similarly collaborate, similarly in that development stage, and also a lot of these technologies and that are sort of pre-competitive. And it's in all our interest to get better sustainability, better health and safety, better returns than that. So I think there's a lot of collaboration that here. And I think the other thing that's helped that is because the oil majors and the energy majors have been doing this for some time, and they've grown up and are mature about the venturing sort of approach, rather than some of the immature approaches of corporates that come into this early on or new industries.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you still have the old corporates asking for ROFRs and ROFINs, Jan. And of course, as an entrepreneur, you should never buy that. But also as a co-investor, we don't like to see that. If our corporate co-investors don't behave by the rules, then yeah, we would rather not have them on the cap table.
Yeah, yeah, good. You, Samantha, my colleague, you.
Yes, please. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you very much. That was an excellent presentation. I actually, on the subject of hydrogen, you mentioned some of the historic challenges around scaling capital and offtake, lack of capital and offtake. In terms of sort of energy security, what's very interesting in China is that hydrogen is becoming increasingly a sort of viable solution for a country that relies very much on importing resources. Does your fund work with sovereign wealth funds or government partners, given that energy security is very much a sort of national priority? Have you had experience of working with government funds, or is there a reason why? Why not?
Thanks. Well, you hit the nail on its head, Sam. I mean, in China, I'd say clearly a focus country for hydrogen business in terms of growth, because they seem to be leapfrogging toward hydrogen in some geographies, which is obviously great because it's a large playground in that sense, and you can reach scale very quickly. And yes, we are having conversations with and also to Kemal's point, with regional, provincial funds to see how we can scale some of these propositions, because that's where you wanna leverage other people's money as well. In the current capital constrained world that we face in oil and gas, of course. We need to find alternative ways to fund some of that growth, and hydrogen is obviously a key area for us in China. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. So I think building on your points on that there, and Kurt's just comment, when we're dealing with corporates, there's all this thing about, are you doing this for financial return, or are you doing it for strategic? And strategic often means, I need to do something in my current business. It needs to be aligned to my current business, which to me is tactical rather than strategic. But one of the great lines that one of our peers came out with years ago was, you don't stay strategic for long unless you make a financial return.
Yeah.
So I think, having those quick wins, showing that you can get a bigger check back than the one you wrote, and then also giving those insights. And as you've raised, Kurt, about bringing these things into the business and helping the business sort of transition and making cost savings, I think is all of those things that happen within a space. But also, built on Bert's comment, I think also that the advantage the corporate venturing unit has, being the top of this crow's nest and investing a few million pounds, euros, dollars in some of these moonshot massive investment type things that the example you just gave, Bert, I think those things help the corporates get that strategic insight in what's happening with the technology, what's happening with the business, but how long is this going to take to change, rather than banking all of the corporate investment on we're going to move from doing oil to becoming a drone business, or we're going to move from being this type of business to this type of business. getting those insights, I think, is so important for a relatively small amount of investment. The last question, which I think partly builds on this, then, there's a question about, Geert, you've got a relatively small venture team around the globe. Do you have access to other resources to support, mentor, contribute to those ventures? Because, you know, you've got to find deals, you've got to do the investments, and then you've got to sit on the boards. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of effort for, you know, and you're not untypical. And I think the corporates that are doing it really well do have small teams, and you don't give you too much money. So how do you leverage that capability, I think, is part of the question that
I mean, bandwidth is obviously an issue. So in terms of scanning and scouting, we do use our scanning fund investments, or our fund of fund investments, quite a bit. We manage those relationships with those GPs really well to understand what's in the hopper and is there anything that is of interest to us. So it's an efficient way to actually scan and scout for opportunities. During the execution, you need to find ways where you like to have the business and the tech people part of the due diligence phase and give their thumbs up in terms of strategic fit and technical viability. But then you want to move them out. You don't want them to fumble too much with your process and be relatively independent and nimble in the way you make decisions. So that helps. And then during the post-investment phase, sitting on boards, we make use of shell retirees, people that have been, you know, VPs or EVPs of a business, mm-hmm. and sit on boards for us, and they get a kick out of it. They're retired. They have got a comfortable cushion, but they love to sort of extend their knowledge to startups and young folks that are developing new capabilities. And so that works really well. And we kind of pick and choose the ones where we want to sit on boards and primarily those that, you know, we believe in the end of the day create the best financial return for us. Yeah. But we do spend quite a bit of time on selecting the right members of boards, because it's so critical that we have the right caliber people there to help these startups grow and prosper.
Yeah, and building on your point on that there, you know, corporates are typically investing up to 20%, maybe in your case up to 30% because of the consolidation issues. And certainly I've got a video series of a corporate and the venture talking from their both perspectives about why they invested in and then when they were on the board. And one of the interesting things that comes across on that was the chief executive sort of said, well, you don't own my company. You've got to, you know, corporates have to realize they don't own the company, even though they've done a small investment. So I think related to this question, you're there bringing other board members in and helping and supporting within that ecosystem for that venture, rather than we know it all, we're coming from a large corporate and you're going to do what we say. So I think corporates being modest sometimes in supporting where they can, but also recognizing they're great in running an oil refinery or an oil exploration, but they're not good at doing digital, they're not good at doing drones, they're not good at doing EV and learning and contributing where they've got the expertise. So I think that this venture team is part of that, being that part of that ecosystem as well. I think corporate venture units, and I know the Shell people are good at that as well.
Yeah, you want to avoid that you have people on the board that have an immediate conflict of interest, as they also are representatives in businesses that serve as customers to those startups. So you got to manage that dynamic very carefully in order to avoid exposure.
There's a chapter in my book, and there's a video about that sort of issue of the board dynamics with Neil Foster, who a number of you know, and that from from the legal side, which is available on our video channel and that as well. So I think I'd like to draw this to a close. Thank Geert very much for your very excellent contribution and insights to Shell and the whole sector and all that. Also, I really appreciate the really very interactive discussions on the chat and very interactive questions that you raised, and very good to see some familiar faces. I'm not going to say old, because Kamel is looking as young as ever, but really appreciate all your contributions and input, and thanks very much. Feel free to reach out to us if you want more information or be involved in a future session. So thanks so much again, Gert, and really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you all.
Seeing you all in person again.
Please do subscribe for future podcasts. And if you like this broadcast, please give it a 5-star rating on iTunes or the platform that you listened on. Thank you.